Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. It's been budget day this week. The levy's in, there's detail on grants and loans and all sorts of other measures to get across. Plus, we'll kick the buckets on big funding announcements on R&D. It's all coming up.
That hardship, I think, is felt by people above these income categories that are shown. So I do think between now and implementation, there should be some systematic work done on what does hardship mean in reality, because it isn't just a simple thing. I think, as we find out in Guild HE, hardship affects different students by the nature of the discipline they study, as well as by their social background or geography.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to open up their red box of HE news, as usual, three fantastic guests. In Shropshire, Ken Sloan is Vice-Chancellor and CEO at Harper Adams University. Ken, your highlight of the week, please.
Highlight of the week has been taking our Specialist Institution of the Year award and passing it from member of staff to member of staff and to students. So that's been great.
Polishing it each time. In Newport Pagnell, David Kernahan is Deputy Editor at Wonky. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
It's a bit of a niche one, but the belated realisation that there is a major university in the UK that on its coat of arms, it has two badly drawn lithium atoms and a large elephant with a castle on its head.
And on that bombshell, in Thorpe St Andrew this week, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's not university coat of arms related, but I did have the pleasure of travelling up to Leeds this week to speak to Advanced HE's PVC-DVC network about the white paper and the implications for higher education futures, which was not quite as somber a conversation as you might imagine.
Great stuff. So yes, we start this week with the budget. On Wednesday, Chancellor Rachel Reeves got to her feet and there were shenanigans before she even got started, Debbie.
Well, I can't speak to any shenanigans, but I very much can. Yeah, the OBR put a major foot in it and released its response to the budget before Rachel Reeves had even stood up. So everybody was treated to the unedifying sight of, during PMQs, every single MP in the chamber scrolling through their phones desperately trying to kind of find out what was about to be said, which I think rather took the wind out of Rachel Reeves' sails. And I imagine some heads will be rolling at OBR. But nevertheless, the budget happened. So for higher education, the kind of broad strokes we already knew about these. So we knew what was happening with undergraduate fees, which is, you know, the big thing that everyone's thinking about. We knew broadly what was going to be happening with R&D. But so the thing everybody was waiting for was the interrelationship between plans for the international student levy and the interrelationship between that levy and the promised targeted maintenance grants that were announced at Labour Party conference. So what we got was the consultation on the international student levy. The proposal is that English providers will pay a flat fee of £925 per international student per year, taking effect from the 1st of August 2028. That, interestingly, the first 220 international students will be exempt from the levy, which is intended to protect the smallest providers. On maintenance grants, we got confirmation that these will be introduced from the 2028-29 academic year. There'll be a maximum of £1,000 a year to the most disadvantaged students, with a bit of tapering in first and second year, and then it'll be £750 a year from third year on. And only full-time students will be eligible for that.
Well, yes. I mean, all sorts in there. Now, Ken, I mean, let's start with the levy. If nothing else, by 2028, anything could have happened in immigration policy.
That's entirely true. I mean, we're going to be planning our finances through one lens, and then we've got to think about what's going to happen in reality. We've also got a turbulent world, so the willingness of people to move may change over time. I think, though, everyone will be welcoming the relative simplicity of this, because I think in recent weeks, everyone's been debating how this percentage is going to work and what it's going to work. But the reality of it is, having a flat fee means that if you charge higher fees, you're going to pay lower tax than someone who charges lower fees. So it is a very differential fee, but I think the simplicity is definitely welcome.
And that, Ken, is a bit of a kind of win for one part of the sector, isn't it?
Yeah. So if you're a smaller institution and you're in a specialism which basically you cannot charge a much higher fee. So that, you know, there are MBAs out there that are charging £45,000. £925 on that is a much smaller fee than if you're charging £15,000. And you're also paying agents and paying scholarships. So the net amount that comes back to the university is much smaller. So hopefully through this technical consultation, we'll be able to work some of that stuff out and work out what that means. But the, you know, the fact that there's 220 upfront students where there isn't going to be a levy charged is really going to help a lot of very small providers. But some of the specialists do recruit well internationally. And I think this will have a disproportionate effect on them.
Now, DK, obviously in the run up to this, there's been lots of reports and lobbying and so on the impact. Now, we're used to reading impact reports on international students from the Home Office. What have the galaxy brains at the DfE decided will be the impact?
So this was an interesting one because obviously with any policy proposal that comes with a consultation, you get an impact assessment report. And obviously, if you're taking money off the one source of income that's been growing in recent years, which is international fees, you're going to reduce the ability for universities to cross-subsidize other things the government might want, like perhaps educating home students or performing research or such like. So the impact assessment, it does recognize this, but we get an intriguing note that this is before accounting for any reinvestment of the levy in the sector. Now, our understanding has always been that the majority of the levy, even though it's not explicitly set out, the majority of the levy would go to funding the new maintenance grants that we will get to. Now, the value of the maintenance grants is difficult to calculate, but it looks to be quite a bit less than the levy. So there is other money sloshing about. There's been kind of intimations from ministers that there might be a little bit of a redistributive agenda here, that perhaps the kind of institutions that can support large numbers of high fee-paying international students are not necessarily the ones that need to benefit from all of the money. And it's a little bit of a way of sharing the wealth. Now, as Ken has said, the flat fee issue means that institutions are paying wildly different tax rates depending on the number of students they recruit and the amount of fees that they charge. And I mean, one thing we've done on the site is actually calculate that tax rate, which is based on 2023-24 figures. So I can tell Ken he will not be paying anything if we repeat the year 2023-2024. But if you look at somewhere like the University of Suffolk, which recruits a reasonably small number of international students who don't pay particularly high fees, they are paying an effective tax rate of 13.69% on that income. You compare that with, say, the University of Cambridge. It has a load of international students and it makes them pay a lot for the privilege of studying there. And their effective tax rate is 2.69. So even if this is to be redistributive, there's going to need to be a lot of redistribution.
Well, Debbie, on the redistribution side, so, you know, one of your roles in life is to tell me if I'm being unfair. So is this unfair, right? It seems to me that on the maintenance loan thing, we have an odd level of specificity about entitlement with this kind of means test and taper and so on. But actually, in truth, no sense really, because we haven't picked the subjects, of how much of the levy is actually going to be spent on maintenance grants.
Mm, yeah, and I think that's pretty deliberate. I don't think that's unfair at all. I think one of the things that is new here, or certainly kind of is being kind of formally confirmed, is that the bulk of the levy will be spent on higher education and skills. But I think the government wants to leave itself wiggle room to decide to what extent it wants to parcel that out into maintenance grants. I mean, and again, you know, there's a little bit of showmanship here, isn't it? Because, you know, Jim, you'll know better than I will on this one, but I don't think £1,000 a year is the thing that's going to really kind of transform participation. It's, you know, it's obviously every little helps, but this is, there's a degree of performativity here in terms of actually kind of addressing some of the challenges that students are facing. So there's also, you know, so in some sense, there's an argument that you don't want to actually lose the whole amount in student grants because you might need to do other things with it. And I think until you've got Skills England up and running, you've got an understanding of the skills landscape and the relationship between skills, local skills improvement plans, which obviously we just had the new guidance for last week, how that kind of gets distributed across FE and HE in different parts of the country and the interrelationship with the industrial strategy. There's a lot of things that need to be unpicked and woven back together that you really don't want to necessarily, from a government perspective, commit to spending the little bit of fiscal headroom you have on committing that before it's been shown that that is going to be the thing that is going to actually help the thing you're trying to do, which is address skills gaps and deliver economic growth. So there's a kind of, you sort of deliver a bit of fairness in one part of the system because you recognize that, you know, maintenance is a real challenge for students and particularly those who don't have that parental support. But you also don't sort of box yourself in a way that means that you then don't have any ability to do anything else in any other part of the system that might more directly contribute to your overall political goals.
Ken, as Debbie says, you know, it's, you know, you get this full grant if your household residual income is 25k or less, tapering off to, you know, 30k of residual household income. And of course, the minimum wage is busy going up. And we know that over the last decade, the percentage of students getting the full maintenance loan, which is also still stuck at a threshold of 25,000, has fallen significantly. I mean, given the state of maintenance, aren't grants a bit of a waste of money?
So when I see how relatively small amounts of money can support students, I think there is an argument for having access to some grants. There's no question about that, because it's a tangible amount of money that they've got access to that they can use. So, and you know, spent a lot of time over the last year talking to students about just what their relative concerns are about money. And it's very, very clear that relatively small sums can make a big difference. I think there's a couple of things though. We're seeing incomes growing at the bottom end through the minimum wage, as you say. And so I do wonder whether some of the cutoffs of these that are proposed are going to be anywhere near realistic by the time we get to implementing them. I also think there are things that can be done to scale it up. So, you know, there could have been a tax break for business to actually match fund the maintenance grants so that they end up with more. That could have been done tied to, you know, investments and various other things that are going to businesses in local areas. So I'm hoping that in the implementation that we can move away from something which just feels a bit low and flat to something that can, one, be tailored a bit more to actual need, because needs are different in different parts of the country. And secondly, that we can think of ways in which we can usefully encourage others to contribute. So, for example, we all know that there used to be a match funding scheme on the philanthropic side, which has helped matters. So that's something that we could definitely be looking at again. The other thing I think that's interesting about it is I haven't seen a huge amount of evidence of students themselves saying nationally to government how much they need and what would make the difference. Because the one thing that we often talk to are the people who came into the sector. I'm not sure we've got much evidence from people who didn't come into the sector to understand what stopped them coming in.
Yeah, the evidence base in terms of need is to some extent all over the shop, isn't it? Both in terms of the campaigning and the actual evidence in terms of what would make a difference. And I guess one of the things, DK, is, and to some extent they're kicking a debate off on this in Wales, aren't they? You can debate whether or not student financial support is supposed to make people comfortable, improve their experience, improve access, reduce dropout. You know, depending on the factor you pick, you might pick a different measure.
You absolutely would. There are lots of potential measures. I mean, we get into this in wider social sciences as well. There are many potential measures of hardship. There are many potential measures of poverty. You just have to look at any statistics that arrive from UCAS to see multiple different measures with multiple different outcomes as to whether students are experiencing hardship. In a way, this misses the point. To me, if a student says that they are experiencing hardship, they are experiencing hardship, and we should be listening to them, and we should be making changes to their support package and the costs that they're expected to cover, which is something that I know you cover on the site this morning, that fairly sets out, okay, this is what you're expected to pay, this is what you are likely to need to pay as regards your living costs. Now, this is going to differ by individual student. You can make generalizations based on the quintile that your parents or guardian's income actually sits in, or, I mean, whether or not you have special educational needs. And in some cases, there are particular costs. I noticed that you spotted some tweaks to the disabled student premium in the budget that would make it slightly harder for students who need a lot of support. I mean, just to physically be able to study at university, that they're potentially going to lose out a bit. It is a definitional problem. The answer probably is to choose a particular set of definitions and stick to them. The danger is that we say a lot of warm words about students that are struggling, but we design interventions that look politically as if they're addressing the issue, but they don't come anywhere close to actually making a difference to actual students.
Just on that, there's a particular thing around the specialist institutions. So if you're in the creative side or you're in anything which has got a science and technology base, there's a whole raft of other equipment that you generally have to be able to access in order to be able to study. So, and that hardship, I think, is felt by people above these income categories that are shown. So I do think between now and implementation, there should be some systematic work done on what does hardship mean in reality, because it isn't just a simple thing. I think, as we found out in Guild HE, hardship affects different students by the nature of the discipline they study, as well as by their social background or geography.
Yes. Now, one of the surprises, I guess, Debbie, was, you know, I could swear that during the election, Bridget Phillipson was roaming around the studios going, graduates, you will pay less. And then the diametric opposite has happened, doesn't it? At least for people on plan two.
Yes. So what the government has done is frozen the student loan repayment threshold.
Donna Donnellan.
They've done a Donnellan. Yeah, the frozen the student loan repayment threshold for those on Plan 2 loans. So that is students who went to higher education between 2012, when the new fee system came in, and 2022, when Donnellan did her Donnelling. Is that right, isn't it? And that was the point at which the repayment rate was extended to 40 years and all the rest of it. I mean, what this does is essentially means that in real terms, you just start paying back earlier. And it's actually the government's done the same with income tax thresholds. I mean, this is in the absence of kind of major taxation reform, this is basically the way that Rachel Reeves has created a bit of fiscal headroom by kind of bringing like nearly a million more people into a higher rate of income tax. And it's the sort of thing that it's a bit of a sort of political fudge, because it is, you can bring in quite a lot of revenue from it, but it means that you're not actively saying we're going to raise the overall rate of tax or do anything that kind of is especially eye-catching. It absolutely goes diametrically against what Bridget Phillipson was talking about in advance of the election. And I guess at that time there was a political calculation that it was people in their 20s and 30s who were most who sort of needed a reason to vote Labour, and particularly in the context of the 2022 reforms in which there, you know, that sort of feeling that graduates were taxed at a much higher rate, and young graduate, you know, recent graduates in particular were being taxed at a higher rate, and there was a feeling among the Labour Party that this was an opportunity. So, I mean, I think what this is naked political opportunism on both sides, and this is the sort of thing that happens, and it's sort of sad to see, but you can understand why it happens.
I'll tell you what though, DK, this cohort hasn't half had a kick in the teeth, because, you know, I was playing with the IFS loans calculator last night, and I'm sure the IFS are going to, not the OFS, IFS, the IFS, the good people at the IFS are going to, you know, confirm or deny this suggestion over the coming days. But playing with the calculator, because they already took a freeze, and because they're now taking another freeze, it looks to me like when all of that comes out of the wash, that cohort, that sort of, you know, last decade cohort, are going to be providing a long-term profit to the Treasury rather than having any of their HE subsidised. That's a far cry from what they were promised in, you know, the middle of the last decade, isn't it?
It is possible that that is the case. I've not obviously done the same late night kind of manipulation of the IFS tool that obviously you've been enjoying, and I salute everybody's personal choices in what they choose to do with the IFS website late in the evening. Not a problem to me. This is an open place. But this is the Plan 2 cohort. So this is people who studied at university between 2012, when the high fees, the 9K fees came in, and August 2023, which is when we replaced it with Plan 5. So the freeze of the threshold obviously affects all graduates, but it particularly affects the kind of new graduates. who have just started working and might perhaps not be earning in total over a calendar year enough to pass the threshold. It makes them easier to pass the threshold and easier to start paying. Of course, that is the cohort, the ones that have just graduated, who were also at universities through COVID. Now, everybody had a bad deal during COVID, but that particular few cohorts of students that were at university during the COVID restrictions had a particularly bad deal. And to look like that their fees are not going to be subsidized at all, and in fact, they're going to end up totally paying more than they earn, it just looks really, really bad. If the IFS confirm this, then it is going to be quite a story, and it'll reignite all of the questions about, are fees reflective of the quality of the student experience? Should the COVID cohort have had some kind of a fee subsidy to deal with the fact that they absolutely did not get what anybody expected or wanted to give them through absolutely no fault of their own? Yeah, the fee system we all expected during the election campaign that there would be some kind of a review of fees and funding. I know that the Liberal Democrats have explicitly promised this. I mean, Labour didn't quite go that far, but as you say, they did hint quite strongly towards a proper sorting out of the funding system. Seems to have been put on the back burner for the moment. It would be good to see some serious thinking on a fairer system for students and graduates, but I honestly suspect we're not going to get that in this parliament.
Now, earlier on in the week, there was some action in Holyrood, and our colleague Michael Salmon was listening in.
Hi, I'm Wonky's news editor, Michael Salmon. I'm here to tell you what happened in Holyrood this week with Scotland's tertiary education bill. The legislation's at stage two, which is the bit where they sort of do line-by-line amendments in committee. It's often the moment where MSPs will sort of be trying to hang new items on the legislation. So that's what we got this week, you know, especially in there was a long debate about possible changes to what's called conditions of funding. So, you know, what all post-16 education bodies will need to do, you know, what conditions they'll need to fulfill in order to receive funding from the SFC in the future. You know, so there were all kinds of amendments put forward on things like fair work, student mental health, student union funding, governance, gender-based violence, all kinds of things, a real mix. And the Scottish Government did give way on some of these issues. We're going to get things like statutory consultation rights before things like course closures. Universities will need to provide conflict of interest registers and sort of do some changes to whistleblowing procedures. You know, and there are quite a few other things elsewhere in the skills system. It's always a bit of a give and take, especially when no party has a majority, either in the Education Committee or in Holyrood itself. But lots of amendments got shot down, either they were withdrawn or they were voted down, often for quite technical reasons, which, you know, weren't very well received by some of the other parties. You know, because sometimes it was about issues that, in theory, it's things the Scottish Government's supportive of, like fair work. So Jim has taken a look at the detail on the site, but there was one particular excuse that the government repeatedly gave for opposing amendments that I want to highlight because I think it's very interesting. And that's the supposed risk that if the government is too interventionist and attaches too many strings to funding and so on, then universities are going to be classified in the public sector by the Office for National Statistics, the ONS. You know, we heard this again and again and again, often in a very woolly way. Admittedly, we do have a very new minister as well. It wasn't clear why it was a bigger concern in some cases, but not in others. You know, so for example, here's the minister, Ben McPherson, shooting down an amendment around mental health support, which actually had been particularly targeted at colleges, which are in the public sector. But anyway, here's what he said.
While I have huge sympathy with the intent behind Miles Prickery's Amendment 63, and would hope that institutions are providing support for students' mental health and well-being in practice without being prescribed to do so, I cannot support the amendment because there is a need to respect the autonomy of our HE institutions in particular, and to avoid attaching so many statutory conditions to their operation through funding that we risk those bodies being reclassified as public ones by ONS. That would create huge issues for government, but also for our institutions, not least compromising their independence, their ability to raise funds from other sources and to act commercially where it is appropriate to do so.
And then there was a great moment a little bit after that where John Mason, another MSP, asked the question that, you know, all the audience is wondering.
Thank you, Minister, for giving way. Could you maybe go into a lot more depth as to how much and where exactly the line is in this? Because I think we're all agreed that we don't want the universities to lose their separate status. But, you know, part of me thinks, well, you know, that's a good excuse not to do anything with the universities because we might be accused of interfering with them. So has he discussed this with the ONS, or has he had advice, or, you know, is he clear where the line is?
And, you know, if you were hoping for a clear answer from the minister, well, you were disappointed. He sort of said something about, you know, there's a cumulative effect of different amendments and different interventions. You know, there's surely some truth in it, though, as I wrote on the site quite recently in an article about the international levy, in fact, you know, the ONS's review of university classifications around the UK has been delayed and delayed and delayed. It's not a priority. You know, they are certainly not waiting to pounce, and there's plenty of things the government could do if it did seem to be kind of coming to a head. You know, so I do feel with this issue of ONS classification, there is a real danger that, you know, the government, in particular in the Scottish government, keeps using it as an excuse to avoid doing things that it doesn't want to do or the sector doesn't want to do, then people are just going to stop believing it.
Now, Ken, elsewhere in the budget, there are some potentially other problems for universities, I guess. You know, this thing about pensions, ongoing national insurance. What's the wider picture for universities?
So the pension issue, we have got more staff who are in defined contribution schemes, and they're the ones that are most likely to be affected. So if you're in USS, some people will be in defined benefits, which won't be affected, but they will be partially in defined contribution. This is going to increase costs for universities. It's going to increase costs as employers. And
just what is it? It's something to do with capping salary sacrifice, right?
Yeah. So you can save, as an organization, as an individual, you can save the amount of national insurance and tax that's paid, because in effect, you're foregoing some of your income, and then the employer is paying into your pension scheme more. But by capping it, then, so if you're a lower paid worker, this is unlikely to affect you because of the amount that you'd put into a pension every year. But if you're a middle income worker, then you're definitely going to see that your employer's costs are going to go up and your costs are going to go up when this happens. But you've also got to see it in the broader context that there are institutions which also have the impact of the teacher pension scheme. So if I look at Harper Adams at the moment, we've got the teacher pension scheme, which has gone up to 28.2% in terms of the employer's contribution. And that compares to just over 14% if you're in USS. We've also had the national insurance increase like everybody else has had. And we do have a high proportion of staff who are in a defined contribution scheme. So the costs of employment are going up significantly, and certainly will continue to go up significantly if the TPS issue is not resolved sometime soon.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the other thing, Ken, on the undergraduate fee increase is, you know, the headline is, it's being index linked, but, you know, this year's 3.1% increase has now been revised by the OBR to a figure that should have been 4.1. So, you know, the OBR have again said, well, it's all right, you know, inflation's going to fall in 18 months' time. You know, suddenly, those compound impacts of the OBR getting its projections wrong are going to hit university budgets as well as student budgets, aren't they?
They are. And also, we're taking, like the rest of the economy, we're taking the headline inflation rate. But the reality of it is prices and costs are affected by different things. So, you know, if you were looking at, again, some of the institutions that I represent within Guild, the type of inflation that they felt in some of the specialist things that they've had to pay over the last 4 or 5 years have been nothing like inflation. They've been double inflation, triple inflation. And it's one of the points I've made over recent months, which is, one, we know that we're not going to catch up on the lost income so far. And I think that's very, very clear. But inflation is a simple way of expressing the costs of what's affecting society and affecting organizations, but it's not representative of the real cost that's being borne by those people. So I do think that notion that, yes, it's great to have the certainty and it's great to be able to plan, and that's going to be helpful for the entire sector and we should be very happy about that. But the notion that this is going to, on its own, transform the financial circumstances of every institution, I just don't think that's right.
Yeah. Now, Debbie, on the student side, I've got a little thing coming out, actually, a one corner coming on student inflation. But in the run-up to the budget, like in the 48 hours before, we normally get the announcement on the minimum wage, and the minimum wage is going to go up again. That's putting pressure on the comparison with graduate starting salaries. But crucially, actually, on the assumption that students are spending a lot of time earning in order to learn, you know, there's a sense from the sorts of employers that tend to employ students that, you know, whilst a minimum wage increase, particularly for under 21s, is going to be good, that will put more pressure on whether they could offer any jobs. Now, you know, is that just saber rattling, or is there, you know, is that a real thing?
Well, I think the increase in national insurance contributions is quite instructive, because employers said, oh, this is going to make employment harder. And everyone said, oh, well, you know, we've got to share the pain and all that sort of stuff. And actually, there has been a genuine downturn in employment. And I guess, I don't know whether that was something that the government had sort of factored in and just sort of thought we've got to be able to take the hit on this, or whether this was unforeseen. But I think that you sort of have to take that sort of thing moderately seriously. I think part of the problem is, I think this is, as the minimum wage has gone up, when the minimum wage came in, employers said we couldn't possibly do this, we can't possibly pay it. And of course that wasn't what happened, but the economic climate was different at that time. So I think there's always just a kind of, I guess, consequences that need to be weighed up. To the extent that students find themselves in that part of the economy for a period of time, they will be affected. But even as Ken says, it won't just be that, will it? It'll be other stuff as well. It'll be about kind of rising costs. But you know, it is very hard to find staff in the hospitality industry, for example, because of immigration changes, and care is another area where you could sort of see students potentially picking up work, you know, for better or worse. And so there's there'll be a lot of other things kind of affecting that. And where students can secure work, then I guess it'll be better paid. So that's basically a good thing, I suppose. Yeah.
Now, DK, if you're someone that has two kids at uni, there are some changes, partly because of the LLE, that mean your parental contributions are going to go up. And if you're a student parent, your special grants are being frozen. What does this government have against breeding?
I cannot let you know what this government has against breeding, although for completeness, we should...
Particularly given population, you know, but generally, most people agree that, you know, our population is falling and our costs of supporting the retired are going up. You know, you'd think that the measures would be the diametric opposite, wouldn't you?
Well, I suppose to offer a little bit of kind of BBC-style balance here, we did get the removal of the cap on child benefit, which is now available to families larger than two. I don't personally believe that tax or financial incentives are a big determinant in people choosing their choice of family, but certainly for larger families, there is a little bit of bad news hidden in the small print of the budget. As things stand, if you've got two kids at university, the system, it kind of recognizes this, and it works out your parental contribution, which is the amount that you're not able to access loans to cover if you're a student. It works that out based on your household income, and then it divides that between the two students you have at university. The example in our article is that if the government works out this family can afford to put in £2,000, then if you've got two undergraduates, you put in £1,000 per child and the government makes up the rest of the loans. So the LLE rules means that they're not going to get that split. Each young person's maintenance is going to be worked out using the household income as if they are the only one studying. Now, that is a big deal. You're effectively doubling your overall contribution if you've got two kids at university, and that like kind of recognition in the system has disappeared. Makes things a lot easier for SLC, but for quite a lot of families, it's going to make things a lot more difficult, and we need to wait to see at what point this comes in so people can start to plan for it. Ideally, they'd probably let people know at some point beforehand as well, but you never know, do you?
Now, Ken, before you answer this question, just to warn you, you know, you may go to jail based on the answer to this question for price fixing, right? But back on the levy, I guess for international students, one of the questions will be, you know, are universities going to attempt to pass it on, right? You know, what goes into that, you know, that thought process?
Well, there's several things. Firstly, the markets that you work with, their ability to pay can affect that. So, you know, there are already institutions that I think would say that they are right at the top end of what their markets, their target markets can bear. So they won't feel that they could pass on that and also pass on inflationary increases and other things. So that's one of the things. Second thing is that every institution is going to have to translate this levy into a reality and look at what it does for its future projections, because in the end, we've all got to balance the books. So we know that the evidence that the CEO of the OFS has given recently in Parliament has said, you know, there are a large number of institutions that are under significant financial distress, and all institutions will be looking at ways through cost savings, but also through income generation to address that. So it is complicated in that way. There's also the thing that we've got to take account of the fact that, you know, often when we talk about international students, everyone will talk about international fees and international contributions, but we've also got to remember that both the country and the universities and the higher education institutions are better institutions by having a diversity of students in the classroom as well as in the general institution. So what all institutions are going to have to do is find a way of saying, you know, one, can they afford this? And if they can, how are they going to do it? But I genuinely don't think it's going to be as simple as people just saying, well, we can up the fees by that amount, because I don't think in all areas the market will bear it.
Now, just before we come off the budget then, psychologically, of course, for home students, the maximum undergraduate fee is going to cross the 10K barrier, DK. But perhaps more importantly, you know, the CMA has new rules out on stating the total cost of a degree when you sign up for it.
Absolutely. So as this begins to land, you can expect any number of hot takes to emerge from the press. If you believe the stories that are told about the design of the system in 2012, the £9,000 fee cap, you'll recall in the Brown Review, it was originally closer to 15,000 in essence. It was designed as 9,000 to avoid that psychological shift from 4 to 5 figures per year. Now, the government has done this quietly. It's obviously not made a big announcement. It's not kind of trumpeted about the fact it's going to be charging students of 5 figures. But this is going to land, and this is going to play into a situation where people are already beginning to question the value of university study. And there is a considerable body of reckons and other hot takes that university might no longer be worth this. If you're looking at a 5K sticker price per year, that's only going to increase. And it has to be hoped that the sector has got some reasonable response to this. Now, of course, the sticker price in a lot of cases is not the total amount that a student has to pay for their undergraduate study. There are also other fees related to everything from lab disposables cost through to site visits, materials, placements, DBS checks, all of this kind of stuff, which, I mean, currently students have to pay for out of their own pocket on top of their fees in many cases. The Competition and Markets Authority has released some guidance which suggests that a university need to be a lot clearer about the total cost and about how much is covered by the fee. Now, this is something that in an ideal world, it would sit alongside the advice and guidance and information that is given to students at the point they're making their applications to university. If you could imagine a version of Discover Uni which people actually are aware of and use, it would be on there, and there would be an understanding on a per course basis. Yeah, you need to shell out for a DBS check. Yeah, you're going to need to commute to a placement, and we're not going to cover that, so you're going to need to budget for your travel. It's not in there at the moment. A lot of universities, they do this, but the practice is not universal. So hopefully this intervention from the CMA means that applicants are going to get a better picture of exactly what they have to pay.
Now, there's a human here, or maybe not. See if you can guess. They're telling us about an event coming up in the new year. Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its 8th year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what Graduate Ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning-making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events. Now, finally, DK, we've also had some news this week on R&D. Help us get across this.
Okay, so this slipped out at the UK's Innovation for Growth Summit. The big headlines people are thinking about is an indication that QR and HIFE, which is the money linked to, I mean, nominally REF performance in the case of QR, and nominally the volume of like spin-out style activity for HIFE, that both of those are going to rise with inflation over the spending review period. We'd kind of hoped this, but we'd not had confirmation, so that's good. But you'll be glad to learn that the big news is about the buckets. Now, this has become an all-encompassing meme that has eaten the entire of research funding discourse in the UK. It all stems from comments from Science Minister Patrick Vallance that he conceptualizes the total research spend of the government in three buckets. So the buckets are curiosity-driven research, research into the government's priorities, which is stuff like the industrial strategy and other things the government might want to do. And the other one is business-related research, so stuff that the economy desperately needs and wants to have. So for the first time, we got an indication of how the budget that was announced in the spending review is being divvied up between these buckets. So it's going to be somewhere in the region of £14 billion for curiosity-driven stuff. This is the traditional grants that are made by the research funding councils, I mean, based on nothing more really than academic interest in the topic. This is £8 billion for research into the government's priorities and £7 billion for business-related research. And there's also another £7 billion knocking about for, I mean, what I swear is described as cross-bucket investment. So this is covering things like infrastructure, all the big cap we need, and research skills as well. Now, this sounds a little bit machinery of government-esque, which is handy because we are talking about Haldane and the Haldane principle here. There's a lovely discourse, which I haven't really got time at this point to take issue with the historicity of from Science Minister Liz Kendall about the Haldane principle, the idea that primarily academics should be responsible for deciding what needs to be researched and to what extent. She does make the point of aligning research with government priorities, and she also gave the Research Council's UKRI a new strategic priority, which is focused on the financial sustainability of research and innovation. So the other little bit of news from this is that the chief executive of UCRI, Ian Chapman, has once again made his remark that the Research Council have been trying to do too much and there are going to be short-term losers as part of a process of making difficult choices.
Now, This is fascinating stuff. Ken, I've got a lot of time for Patrick Vallance, partly because I think psychologically, I mainly think of him in terms of thank God Boris isn't talking back from COVID days, right? And, you know, I mean, look, this sounds like it kind of makes, you know, lots of sense where you've got someone like Patrick Vallance in charge. But once you establish these three buckets, couldn't, you know, future governments with a slightly different agenda punch all sorts of holes in those buckets?
Yeah, they certainly can, because if the vast majority of the income that is going to be distributed on research is going to be connected to either government priorities or infrastructure and commercialization, then the priorities of the government will have a significant effect on the future shape of research. And that could lead institutions to have to adapt themselves and choose to adapt themselves in effect to follow where those funds are going. I think there's another thing though, which is, and I've seen it in some of the comments that have been made already, which is that, you know, well, this means that the vast majority of what's being suggested should be going to larger institutions, almost as if that's the assumption that excellence in research and excellence in impact is only vested within larger institutions. And I would make a really strong case back to UKRI that excellence is actually found in many different types of institution. I hope they don't go for a shortcut in the way in which they administer this to end up giving just larger sums to fewer institutions, as opposed to thinking about the contribution that individuals can make. If I think about my own institution, we put a lot of effort in to the research income research profile. And you know, we got a letter recently commending us on our success rates compared to other success rates. So I just hope that there is sufficient space within the way in which this is being implemented, that the type of institutions we have within Guild HE are properly recognized. I also think there's a bit of a concern that, you know, this is all being pushed at the same time as we don't have certainty over what's going to happen with the REF. So the sooner that gets clarified and we can see this all in the round will help institutions to be able to work out what role they're going to play in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ken's right. The real risk here is dashing to the assumption that the goal here is to give more money to the Russell Group and less to everyone else. Because I think one of the things the buckets does, one of the things that bucket theory, if you will, of research says, we want to there's a bucket for curiosity driven research, and that's really important. We don't know where that's going to lead, but there's this bucket for things that we think are really important right now. And it strikes me that Ian Chapman defines the buckets as being kind of further knowledge, improve lives, and drive growth. And it's that improving life space where institutions of all kinds have really kind of tangible evidence about the impact that their research has and its immediate application. And I haven't seen anything to tell me that the conclusion that UKRI or ministers have come to is that sort of research only happens in research intensive institutions. I do, however, think that where an institution has some real research kind of tentpole marquee stuff and a bit of a long tail of stuff that is done because academics like it and all the rest of it, really tough decisions will have to be made about what that investment in those other bits looks like. Because I think there is always going to be a case for keeping research going, but I suspect that the financials will not support it in every case. And there will need to be some quite thoughtful conversations about the role of unfunded public research in universities and where that sits. And I think that's something the sector should be kind of tackling.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Ken, Debbie, DK, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.